business owners likely will have only one shot to sell a business. Most don't understand what drives value and how buyers look at a business. Until now. Welcome to the How to Sell a Business podcast, where every week we talk to the subject matter experts, advisors, and those around the deal table about how to sell at maximum value. Every business will go to sell one day. It's only a matter of when. We're glad you're here. The podcast starts now.
On today's episode, I had the opportunity to visit with Genevieve Rogers of PEMDAS Winery Solutions. And she, boy, I can't even begin to tell you everything that we learned during her episode. It went a little bit longer, and she was so generous with her time. But she's a winery consultant. And if you just Google her name, you will find that she is everywhere. And so she's an MBA. She's an engineer by trade. She's also, she's a level 3 of the Wine and Spirit Educational Trust. She does all kinds of work as far as strategic planning, company or winery positioning. And she was just such a wealth of knowledge. And I guess the reason I really wanted to have her on was, number one, I don't know anything about wineries. We've sold a few in the last probably 5-10 years. But they were difficult sales. And there's a lot of, believe it or not, there are a lot of wineries throughout the country. And those business owners at some point will want to sell. So the rough rule of thumb is that it takes 1 to 2 years to sell a winery. And I wanted to learn where's the risk in the winery, how to mitigate that risk, and then how to effectively transfer those businesses. And she did not disappoint. She was, like I said, so generous with her time and such a wealth of knowledge. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Genevieve Rogers of PEMDAS Winery Solutions. I'm your host, Ed Meisigland. On this podcast, I interview buyers, sellers, and advisors about what creates value in a business and then how that business is effectively sold at a premium value because sellers and business owners now understand what creates values in their company. So on today's show, you have no idea how excited I am to visit with Genevieve Rogers from PEMDAS Winery Solutions. And I am such a novice at anything wine related. I have a buddy of mine, John Baker, that always makes me look good as far as wine selection. So I'm fortunate to have somebody in my corner, but now I'm going to get a lot smarter because I got Genevieve. So Genevieve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ed. I am pleased to be here.
So tell me about PEMDAS Winery Solutions I haven't seen any business named PEMDAS, but I know what it means. So tell me about it.
Well, that's why I picked it I'm an engineer by my original training. And so, sort of a math geek. So when I started this business, I really wanted to help people work through how to start a winery, how to run a winery, how to have a winery in an organized manner. And so being a math geek, I came to PEMDAS, how you, in a organized method, solve a mathematical equation.
You know, that makes total sense. That's a great way to look at how your practice is. I wouldn't have guessed it, but you know, I always just figured it was, you know, you were just messing with acronyms, but there was a substantially more thought that went into it. And that's awesome.
Probably too much thought, but yes. And it's interesting to me. There's people who are in certain groups that see PEMDAS and say, oh, I know what that is. It's in that math. And people who look at me and say, like, what is that? I have no idea. And which I think is really interesting. But since I like math, it works for me.
I get it. So you're based out of Oregon, right?
Well, that's where my home is. But I work
again.
My clients are all over the United States, and okay. I have some international clients. So I do a lot of, you know, a lot of my work from home office, a lot of my work over the internet with clients, things that can be shared electronically. And then, I do winemaking, consulting on site for clients. And so then I travel and I'll be at the winery.
Well, awesome. So I'll apologize in advance, for some of the silly questions that I'm certain I'm going to ask, that probably would be rudimentary to folks like you. So I appreciate the latitude, but the first thing that I guess we should talk about is that there's differences in wineries. Like you were talking about case thresholds, like there's the larger operations versus the smaller operations. And I think the people that listen to this podcast are probably more geared to the smaller side, but can you talk about, because there are some substantial differences, right? Other than volume.
There are some really big differences, and it's almost like being in two different industries. And people can think about it in like the difference between your local hardware store and Home Depot. And that's kind of where the winery is. So you have some really, really big players in the United States and across the world that make millions of cases of wine. But most of the wineries in the world, most of the wineries in the United States are making less than 5,000 cases of wine annually. So what you see in the stores, and if you're going to grocery stores, you're seeing primarily the big wineries, really big million cases annually of wineries. And then you might see some local wineries that are smaller scale. And you might see some wineries that are kind of mid-size that make specific products of a specific value that they're big enough to be picked up through distribution and sold across the nation. But the majority of wineries are really fairly small, under 10,000 cases, and wineries that are like family owned, you know, they're small. So sure. their cost basis is very, very different. And the way they sell wine is very different because their cost basis is so different than selling through the distribution market is taking their margin and cutting it at least in half. And so that becomes a real boundary for small business, for small wineries. Is like, can I take my, when I have a higher cost basis, am I going to be able to sell it at half?
Oh, I get
to
it.
Sell it through distribution. So it sets up really sure. almost two different industries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that explains a little bit about why you see all of these small operations having, what's the best way to put it? Like on site, you know, I don't want to say tourism type winery. But it seems as though that is more so why they do it, because that's how they get the distribution as opposed to going through your normal distribution chain, right?
That's correct. And really, if you look at what the sales distribution for small wineries, and you look at averages, and you look at wineries that are doing well, they should be selling 85%+ of their sales directly to the consumer. So you're either doing it through your tasting room, you're doing it through your wine club, you're doing it through your website. That's your direct to consumer market. And for small wineries, like if you're under 20,000 cases, the vast majority of your sales should be through those markets. So then you need a tasting room, somewhere where you connect with customers. If you're a huge winery, there's not a whole lot of value in that for you.
I get it. Well, and now that totally makes sense. One of the things that I guess, can you take me from cradle to grave? So we start with grapes and then we end with a bottle of wine in the consumer's hand. Can you, what is the mechanics of all of that from a high level? You don't have to get too far in the weeds.
So
I know you work with startups.
I do work with startups. So there's, I like to say that there's three different types of people in a winery. The first type of person is a farmer. So you're going to grow grapes, and grapes are a perennial. They're a lot more like having an orchard than other types of fruit, because you'll plant for the next 25 years. That plant's going to grow for 25 years, if not more. So it's a real dedication to the land, to that crop, to those individual plants. And you want a good winery that has its own grapes. You don't have to. But a good winery that has its own grapes is growing grapes that work with that climate and those soils, and that produce a wine that customers like. And you have to do all of those things. So grapes are kind of a weed. They'll grow anywhere. But what you need is you need a grape that will grow well, that will give you volume and quality in which to make a product that people are going to like at the price point that you need to sell it for.
Okay.
You have to do
all of those. Can I ask you about the grapes?
Sure.
So if I'm a farmer, does the winery owner, if I don't own the farmland, and do I get exclusivity? Is that how it works? Or if I'm a farmer, I'm going to sell it to anybody that needs my grapes.
You know, most wineries have contracts with farmers. It's sort of, a little bit depends on the area that you're in, and the ability to get grapes. If you're a farmer and you are growing grapes really well, you should look for contracts that are long term, and you build a relationship. And that's really what a winery wants too, because the winemaker wants consistency, and they want to be able to direct the grape growing practices. And so for that, you need a relationship.
So the winery that hires that contracts with the farmer, they have control over certain aspects of the farming other than just the product?
It's by contract. And so everything is a little different. Sometimes wineries will have long-term contracts, and then it makes sense for those two organizations to work together and farm in a certain manner. Wineries will often get to a point where they'll be growing, or where the volume that they're getting from one farm isn't enough because of the year, and they buy basically on the spot market. And then you're just getting whatever someone grew.
I see. All right. So first thing you said is three parts. We had farmers. What's our second part?
The second part is the winemaker. So the winemaker is this person who has a really high attention to detail, is somewhere between a scientist and an artist. They make the wine. And I like to say, like, a good winemaker is a little bit OCD. There's a lot of attention to how the wine is made on a daily, hourly basis. And you want someone who's really methodical. And so that person is going to bridge the two parts. They will direct some of the growing to get the raw product that meets their quality standards and their chemistry that they're looking for. And then they work with the sales, which is the third person, to make a wine that's going to match what's being sold.
Got it. So, go ahead.
And so the winemaker is going to get the grapes in. They process it through the harvest. You ferment it. There's different processes during fermentation. And then you press it and you put it into tanks or barrels to age it. And then you and then you bottle it, and bottling then goes to this third person, who is the sales management person.
Got it. So on the the scientist or the chemist, how hard is it to find somebody that does that? Is that just somebody you hire, or is that typically the owner?
Yes. For small wineries, it is typically the owner. And the owner either has that background. I see a lot of first-time owners that have backgrounds in engineering. So the owner either has that background or they go out and get that. Well, there are programs around the country that teach winemaking to adults who have already graduated. So Cornell has a program, Penn State has a program, University of California, Davis has a program, San Luis Obispo. There's a whole bunch of programs around the country where you can take online or in-person classes as a professional already.
Go ahead.
And you get a certification.
Finish your thought.
You get a certification in winemaking.
And that gives you enough knowledge to produce a a commercial grade wine, huh? I wouldn't have known that.
Yeah, well, and you can go the route. I mean, that's sort of the route I took. I have an engineering degree. I have an MBA. When my family started a winery, nobody had ever made wine. And so I took classes. I became the winemaker with my engineering degree and my MBA. And I took classes and I worked with a consultant or a couple of consultants.
Okay.
And so I was learning, but also I was, you know, the consultant would say, okay, do this today. And I would go and do that. But then I was learning at the same time. So you can do both. You can do one or the other. It really depends on your temperament and how much work you want to put into it. Because there is a lot that you need to know to make wine well. Or you can hire somebody.
And that's what I was getting at, is that it seems like the astute wine people in my life, they are always talking about different things about the wine. And so when we're talking about chemistry and stuff, I'm sitting here going, okay, how do I learn this over, you know, online, in order to be able to produce something in a manner that is, attractive to the consumer. You know what I mean? Yeah. But I mean, it makes sense. So you worked with somebody and that's probably what other people do too.
And I do it. It's one of the things that I do, is I come to wineries and I train people to take over my job basically. And so, and while I'm not there, they're doing the work. We're talking, I'm saying do this, they do that, but they're also learning intensely on why this is happening, so that they can then take.
Well, I thought it was so much more about tasting and tailoring it based on a palate that you were going for.
Well,
and
there is,
and that
it is too.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So it's a, that's why I said it's.
So how do we do
it? Yeah. So it's science and art. Because you,
I get it.
You okay. can't do it straight on the chemistry. So when got the wine it. And wine is made usually during fermentation is really when the wine is made, and that's a couple of weeks. And during that time, so if I'm making wine and I'm at a winery, I will taste every single tank, barrel, lot in the winery at least once a day, if not twice a day, if not three times a day. And then I will make changes to how the fermentation is going based on those tastes. So you do have to do both. And you also have to understand, if I want a product that tastes a certain way at the end, after it's aged, what do I need to do now during fermentation in order to get that? And that's something that takes, you have to have the mind for it, but you also have to have some experience doing that.
I get it. All right. So you had talked on the third part, which is the sales. Right. So what is, at this level, I mean, what is the optimum route to maximum value? Who is, I think we've established that probably you don't want to go to a distributor because you don't have the volume to accommodate that. So it sounds to me that it's direct to consumer. And, you know, the ways that if I heard you right, was your tasting room, events and online, right? Those are the three, or did I miss
it? And wine club, which is actually the backbone. So the best thing that someone can do, if someone has a winery or is starting a winery, the most important thing that they can do is determine what experience they are creating their wine. That is by far the most important thing that a winery can do to be successful. Is what experience do I want people to have when they visit, when they come to my winery and come to an event, when they taste my wine at home, when they come to my website? What do I want them to feel? What am I creating for them? Because what people who love wine and get into the industry think that it's all about the wine, because that's what's been important to them while they've been drinking wine, is it's about the wine. This wine is fantastic because of this criteria. But that's not actually how wine is sold. Huh. Wine is sold based on the experience that people have, and the wine is integral. But it's not always the most important, but it is integral.
Okay.
So that's the first thing that people should do is really, and if they have a winery and they're thinking, like, I would like to sell this at some point, they need to nail that down. What am I creating? And then figure out, is that what I think I'm creating or what I'm actually creating? Because those two things can be different. Sure. And does everything match? Is the experience I'm trying to create, does that match the wine that I'm selling? Is it match the prices that I'm selling it at? Does the label match? What about the packaging? How about my website? And when people call me on the phone, is it all consistent?
But when you're making wine, when you're sub 20,000 cases, is it cases? So how does, I mean, I follow what you're saying. What I'm trying to reconcile with is, can they create that brand consistency that you're talking about? You know, and again, it's back to the wine, you know, so you have a great product. And so how do I make everything downstream tie together? You know what I mean? And I'm certain that's the trick in your industry is, you know, if they knew, you wouldn't have a job, you know?
Yeah.
And so
this is true. So, and this is why I get myself out of a job. How do I teach people how to do this? So yeah. You start first with the experience and what you want people to, what do you want people to have? So there's a winery in Napa called Opus One. And I use it because lots of people know it. It's they make a single wine, one wine a year, period.
Okay.
They tell you this is a singular wine. It's part of their vision statement is it's a singular wine that transcends generations. That's their vision statement. So
okay.
That's what they do. So if you imagine in your head, okay, well, what does that look like? It's going, the place is going to be something you remember. You're going to look at that building and go, oh, that's it. That looks like an homage to wine. That looks like a wine museum where the best wines would be stored, right? Then your price is going to match that. So that's not a $20 bottle of wine. That's a $300, $400 bottle of wine. So all they do a really good job, and that's why I use them, is because everything matches. So same, but it doesn't have to be the best of the best. You can have a place where families come. Families come and they have a great time together. Well, what does that look like for a wine? It's going to be a lower price point. You're going to have a bigger breadth of wine. Some of it will probably be sweeter off dry. You're going to have whites and reds. That's kind of how you progress through this.
I got it. And I think that's where business owners get themselves in trouble is they're looking at volume rather than playing the long game and get the experience down and the money and the profit will follow. That totally makes sense.
And part of the thing is something that you kind of maybe didn't realize you were alluding to at the beginning. Most consumers don't really know a lot about wine. Like, you're not unusual. Most consumers don't know a lot about wine. They like what they like. They've tasted a wine. It tastes good to them. That's what they know. And so when you think about it in that manner, it's really not as much about the wine itself because people don't know a lot about the wine. What they know is that they had a good time. Everybody enjoyed themselves.
Yep.
Or someone that they know recommended this. They probably drank it together.
Right.
And so wine, especially for small wineries, really need to get out of, and this is hard because I'm a winemaker. You really need to get out of this idea that it's all about the wine because it's not.
Okay. That's great advice. So, you know, we were talking about the farmers earlier and we've got some pretty funky, weather going on, you know, these days, you know, how does that affect, you know, cause one of the things you were talking about when we talked last was how, you know, how important it is to kind of foresee, you know, what is the outlook for the region? And I guess as a business owner, you know, I value companies all the time. And one of the things, the tenants is what does the future look like for this particular investment? And I'm looking at a winemaker and they're trying to forecast what the farmland and the farmer and the climate looks like down the road. So how do you do that? And how do you pivot if it goes back?
Well, so, you know, one of the benefits for winemaking is, like I said, wine grapes are kind of like a weed. They will do well in a climate range. So, but you do want to target the varieties that is going to do better in your climate range. And there's a lot of them. And then part of it is you go to if you're in the United States, you go to your extension program, which works with agricultural and farms, and you say to them, what's growing in my state? And you work to make sure that the land is going to be good for grapes and that you pick the right grapes for it. And then there is some looking forward, and it depends on how much risk you want to take. If you plant a grape right now, you'll get a good crop in 5 years. The climate's probably not going to change substantially in that 5 years to make this grape non-viable. It's still going to be viable. It will still be viable in 10 years. There might be a grape that's kind of on the edge of your climate that you may take a risk on and say, I'm going to plant that now because I can see what's been happening with the climate in my region, and this is going to be really good in 10 years. That's, you know, that's a risk, and it depends on how risk averse you are.
Well, and that's what I was we were talking, as it was a question I was going to ask that a little down the road was, you know, it takes, especially in selling wineries, I mean, you're talking 1-2 years to sell it, to find the right buyer and to sell it. And then on top of it, trying to see into the crystal ball what my crops are going to look like or what my grapes are going to look like, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road. And I guess my question is, how do I lock in the farmer? Do contracts go out that far, or are they 1 year and then 1 year renewables? You know what I mean?
Contracts are all over the map. And contracts in the Midwest are very different than contracts in California, where 85% of the wine in the United States is made. So what is common is a multi-year contract that is more like 4 or 5 years, or a 1 year renewable contract. And the contract, you know, the contracts are with the business, but there's a lot of contracts that are really with the owners. So if you're purchasing a winery that doesn't have its own grapes, you want to talk to their grape sources and get a feel for, you know, do I want to work with these people? Are they going to give me the quality that I need? Are they going to give me the volume that I need so I can be consistent and have a consistent cash flow?
So why wouldn't someone do that? I mean, why would, if I'm a buyer and you're a seller and I meet your, you know, your farmer and I like him or her and, you know, we kind of get along. Why wouldn't they want to do business with me? You know, I mean, is it all economic?
No, it's not.
Because
it's
we
not
were
all
talking
economics.
About
like,
this
no,
the
not.
Other day about goodwill.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's hard for me to answer that question because I've seen vineyard owners that say, I want a 5-year contract and let's write out how we're going to value the crop so that it's reasonable for everyone. I want to do that. And I want you to take all of my crop, like everything I grow, I want you to take. And then I've seen some growers who say, I want like 5 buyers every year. I don't want one buyer because I don't trust that they're going to do right by me every year. And so it's very individual.
I get it.
And And part of it also depends on where you're located and what experience those growers have makes a big difference too. And when I say experience, I mean experience working with wineries.
Yeah, yeah. I follow you. Well, like I said, it's one of those things of boy, you know, everything is sizing up risk. And, you know, the prospect of losing your supplier that – because, again, it's back to I guess my question then becomes, does the farmer have the leverage over the business owner or the winemaker? Who has leverage in that equation?
It depends on the scarcity, really. You know, if you're the only grower –
That makes sense.
Then you're the only grower. You're the only game in town. If you're one of 50, then it doesn't. So that's where it really starts to make a difference. And then it's personality. You're working with people and it's getting a good, you know, good mix that both people work together.
Okay. So what do typical owners look like these days? What's an owner of a winery look like?
So for a small winery, you know, it's all over the map. If I look at like my clients, I have clients who started wineries who are retired. They made money, and one gentleman who is just opening a winery in New Jersey said, you know, Genevieve, I spent my career making money and doing things for other people. Now I want to do something for me. This is for me. So that is one group.
Okay.
Another group is people. I get a lot of people who are younger than I am. So they're in their 20s and 30s. I mean, I guess at my age, a lot of people are younger than I am, but they're in their 20s and 30s. And they, some of them have legacy farms in their family. Okay. And so now they're going to turn a legacy farm that was growing, you know, is growing corn or soybeans or something else and change the way that farm works. And then it's all over the map. Usually it's people who have liked wine and who want to do something different, and they want to do something that they're going to love. And that's really important if you're going to buy a winery, because people who buy wineries, unless you're buying it for someone else to run, it will become your life. There's really not an in-between. So you want to love it.
So I get it. It strikes me that the avatar of somebody that wants to get into this business is a high net worth individual that is either on one side of the scale, meaning they're at retirement age looking for kind of the next chapter of their life, or they're on the younger side and they're trying to set the world on fire, but yet they have the net worth to pour into something like this.
True for the most part. I find that the people who are younger who are starting this, they're really bootstrapping it, but they don't have to purchase the land. And so that makes a huge difference in how much money and capital you need to start it. And you can do that. But I think you're right. For the most part, you're going to be looking at people who have equity and have money to spend.
Yeah.
And either or have equity and have a group behind them that has the capital.
I get it. So does... So how, I know you just alluded to private investment. I mean, do these things get financed through conventional means, like through the SBA or through conventional banks, or how are you familiar with that? And I know I'm kind of jumping all over here, but I'm just kind of curious to see how that works.
The bigger wineries, the bigger startup wineries do get with commercial banks and conventional loans. For smaller wineries, it's harder to it's you really have to make the case. And it is one of the things that I do. So I create 10-year financial forecasts that you can take to a bank. But you have to take it to a bank who understands what's going on, because this is not something that you can just turn around the next year, right? It's this is a long-term project. So startup wineries do not make money the first year or the second year. And they start getting to the black on an annual basis in their third or fourth year. But it does take 5, 6, 7, 8 years to actually get truly profitable, where you paid back your loans and all of your capital.
Sure.
And now you're actually making money.
Now, are those capital sources exclusive to the industry? I mean, because my point is, I'm certain there's a lot of people that are probably listening saying, you know what? You know, if I get a buyer, you know, I'm going to call Genevieve because she knows where the capital is, you know, that I have lenders that specialize or understand this industry and the risk profile.
There are lenders. There are lenders people? That specify that do like it is. Let me just say, it's not my forte. But yes, there are. Most of them, a lot of them, are in California, or they're ag. They're ag based banks. You can get, can qualify for SBA loans. It's sort of a hard sell, but you can do it. And I've worked with the SBA. But you really, and you probably have had this experience, like when someone's trying to get funding for a project, you're going to be looking, if you're buying a winery, first you're looking at their cash flows. And do they have positive cash flows for years, not just this year, but do they have a history of positive cash flows? That makes it goes a long way to a buyer saying, or a lender saying, yeah, I'll lend that to you, because I'm looking at their years of positive cash flow. If you're starting up, that's a more difficult sell.
Yeah. Sure. It always is. I get it. I'm bumping up on time. Do you have time for a few more questions? All right. So on the coronavirus, how did that affect the smaller business? Did it affect the supply chain as much as it did for a lot of the larger business, wineries?
It did affect the supply chain for the larger for smaller wineries, primarily at the end of the of making wine, which is bottling. Small wineries have and continue to have a very difficult time getting bottles, and that's been a problem. Yes,
really?
And it's been a really, really substantial problem that is ongoing, because what is happening in the Ukraine is affecting the cost of energy in Europe, where a lot of the bottles are made, and bottle making is high energy usage. And so not only are costs going up,
I had no idea,
but the supply is going down. That's been the biggest, as far as supply chain, that's hit the industry. Is in bottles. The pandemic affected the industry differently in that it closed a lot of tasting rooms and the ability to for people to come in to your tasting room.
So
wineries had to pivot, and wineries that did well did pivot. They kept in touch with all their consumers. They worked their wine club. They worked online sales and classes and meet the winemaker, and they did all that. And the industry in the United States actually grew through the pandemic.
Yeah, that and that totally makes sense, because one of my questions was, as restaurant usage is declining, the consumer usage
is growing,
right? And so, yeah, and based on what you were saying on the areas of the areas where you create value, through the tasting room, through online, and through the wine club. I mean, it probably the pandemic for the smaller wineries, if you played it right, probably did pretty good for you. That your margins actually probably improved, right?
Yeah, the wineries, the small wineries that had a wine club to start with and built consumer loyalty and built interactions with their consumers over the years before the pandemic, they were able to leverage that and continue to give real value to their customers who stayed with them. And not only did they stay with them, but they bought more wine. And their cost basis then went down because they didn't have an employee in a tasting room and have to staff that. Now they're staffing someone shipping wine and moving wine as opposed to the tasting room. So the wineries that did that really well, like, they made out, because now all of that infrastructure is still good. It's still viable. People still buy wine over the internet. They still want that interactions. So if I'm, if I'm now looking and I'm a winery buyer, I would look at, show me how you did during the pandemic. Like, what is your wine club like now? How are your interactions? Because those have real value.
But conversely, if I'm the buyer and I'm saying, oh, you didn't capitalize on the wine club, you didn't capitalize on the online, from a buyer standpoint, am I not sitting there saying, wow, I have a tremendous opportunity to take advantage of something you didn't? Or has that ship already passed?
It has not passed. That opportunity is always there. And really, from a buyer point of view, then what you would do is you would look at and they say, a wine club is based on the brand. The value of the wine club is
okay.
How you value the how you value the brand. And so,
okay,
if they haven't done that, then the value of the brand, which is this, what we call this goodwill amorphous value that we put on when we're selling something, that declines. And most likely you're going to come out with a new brand and do something else.
Okay.
So yeah, it does give you that opportunity, but your starting point though is then lower from a sales perspective.
Right. No, I but if I'm the seller, I didn't take advantage. I chose not to do what, maybe I wasn't aware of what to do, but nevertheless, that's where the value is. And you talked about this a little bit when we originally talked, was, this is the goodwill component tends to erode very quickly, meaning that there, you've got inventory, you've got the equipment, and now you have what we're talking about is goodwill. And then goodwill separates into personal goodwill or the branding. And then you have corporate goodwill is, you know, the earnings that you can forecast. So where I was going with this is I'm curious to know if you're coaching a seller, how do I sell that I have that goodwill? Because the equipment is right. What it is, you know. How do I demonstrate that I do have the goodwill? So I know you said, you know, I'm certain it's mailing list, wine club. But I mean, what other things am I? How am I going to withstand the scrutiny of a buyer? Well, how would you coach a seller in that scenario?
For the goodwill, you're looking at a couple of things. One, you're looking at the wine club, which is an annual income that is really easy to forecast and put a value on. Okay. So that's a big piece, and that's probably going to be a significant portion where you say, look, I've got this value because I have a wine club and it's this size. Another thing that you're going to look at is how many people walk through your door. And if you're going to sell your winery, you should be counting those people and literally tallying every single person who walks through your door, because there's lots of potential sale. And as a winery consultant, I can tell you what that potential sale is. There's a real value to how many people walk through your door. You may take advantage of it or you may not. But I think that's a piece of the goodwill. And that has to do partly with your location, partly with your marketing, how you're branded, how people know you. So those would be the two biggest things that I would say, like, maximize your value of those two things, because you can really sell those, and those are that goodwill value.
I got it. What do buyers look like? I mean, I know we said here's what a seller looks like. We've got our, you know, we're on both sides of the spectrum. So buyers these days, is it the same avatar? Or the first question is, are you seeing wineries sell? And two, who's doing the buying?
So small wineries, the reality is most small wineries don't actually sell well. And you talked about this, like, it takes a couple of years. Okay. Most small wineries don't actually sell well. And most of them just close. They don't have these cash flows, right? They haven't done, either they don't know how, or they were not able to, for whatever reason, they don't have this. And so their brand, the winery brand, doesn't have a lot of value. Now, their property has value. The buildings have value. Their equipment may or may not have value. Unfortunately, a winery equipment, I was asked today by someone who's starting a winery, and he says, well, how long do I keep this? And I told him, I said, well, I can hear your children in the background. They're the ones who will replace this equipment that you're buying. That's the lifespan of equipment, and his children were young. So, we were talking about, like, what does this person look like? People who are buying. So one, most wineries don't sell. That's just the reality. Most wineries close. The wineries that sell are selling to someone who wants this as a lifestyle, because it is a lifestyle. Yeah. You may be selling it to someone who has made money, who's been a real high achiever, like a lawyer or a surgeon or someone who's been in construction or building, and And they've done something for a long period of time. They have equity and they have capital. Now they want to do something for them. And that's the kind of lifestyle that they want to lead.
I get it.
Like, those really are the buyers.
Okay. Back to the sellers, though. If I engage you, and I have two questions that kind of go hand in hand. So can you coach me, if I'm a business owner, can you coach me into making my winery a marketable asset to a buyer? And if so, how long does it take? And then the third question is, how do I work with someone like you? It seems to me like you're going lots of places. How do we work together?
So as a seller, if you're a seller and you want to sell your winery, it's a long-term process. Unless your winery is sale ready. Okay. Sale ready,
tell me what that
you
means,
have yeah. years of cash flow that are positive, that are consistent. You can show that you have put in money to keeping up your equipment, to training your staff, to your facility. Like, you have been doing ongoing maintenance and everything is in real working order. You've got those two things. From just a straight production business side. Okay. The next thing that you need to have is you need to have wine that is what we call in the industry clean. It needs to be good wine. And so it needs to be free of faults, because faults are a winemaking problem that make the wine not taste good to consumers. They also, wine that has faults has no value to a buyer. So if I've got a whole bunch of wine in tank, but that wine has faults, that wine has no value to seller. So it's bad inventory.
So it's just bad inventory. So got it.
I would work with you to fix that, but that takes 1 to 2 vintages minimum, because you have to get through that wine. So you do those things and then work to build your wine class.
What is a vintage?
So that's okay.
Sorry about that.
Grapes are harvested one time a year in the United States. We put the number, the vintage, which is the year that you see on the bottle, is based on when we pick those grapes. Okay. So right now, the vintage that is in tanks in people's wineries is 2022. But what you're seeing coming out in the marketplace would be 2021 and 20. Okay?
Got it.
So it takes a while.
That makes sense. Good. Thanks.
So if you want to get there, you've got to get through a couple of vintages, which is years. To get sale ready.
Okay. Right. So I need a couple years with you.
Right.
To get sale ready. Okay. And during that time, you're going to work on faults. You're going to work on how to improve cash flow and how to shore up the online, wine club and tasting.
Right. And I do depends on what people need, but some of it, I come on site. So I would come on site and we'd taste through all your wine. Every single thing you have. And we would talk about what's going on, where you need to go, and how do you get there. And then some of it is 1 hour sessions where we talk on the phone and you say, okay, Genevieve, this is what I've been doing. This is where I am. And I say, okay, well, here's your next steps. Like, this is where you need to concentrate. What questions do you have? How can I help you understand? And then you as the winery owner, you then have to execute.
Got it. Okay. So I guess, and I always kind of conclude every podcast with, you know, what is the one piece of advice that you would give that would have the most impact on somebody's business? And I'm assuming it's preparing, but I may be wrong.
If you want to go into this industry or you're in this industry, if you've got a winery, you want to start a winery, the most important thing that you can do is fully understand, write down, and encompass what is the experience you're creating. How are you creating it with every single thing you do? That is, in this industry, that is going to be the most impactful for your business in the wine industry.
Awesome. So, how do people connect with you? And number two, how does your process work? How do I work with Genevieve?
The best way is my website. It's winery.consulting is my website.
Okay.
So, or if you go to Google and you type in winery consultant, I'm at the top of the list. That is the easiest way to find me. And then you go on my contact page and say, and it sends me an email and says, Genevieve, here's what I've got. Let's connect. And then we set up a 1 hour phone call or video conference. And that's the way that it 1 hour works, and people, you know, they say like, this is what I need. And we'll decide, like, am I the right person for you? Because it's important to me that we get the right fit. And then go forward, and it depends on what you need. You know, sometimes people need hourly work. Sometimes they may need me on site for a day, 2 days a week. I'm flexible in that. And then we go from there.
Yeah. Okay, so you scope the work, and this is what I need, and you scope it. This is kind of the mechanics of and the deliverables.
Yeah, and that's my background too. So with Genevieve, that's exactly what I do. It's like, here's my deliverables. Here's my
right on.
Here's the step of the project. This is how much it costs. Like, that's what I do.
I get you. Well, Genevieve, I'm telling you, this will probably be, we're probably bumping up into 80 episodes, and I'm fairly versed at a lot of the things that I'm talking about, but you enlighten me so much about how this world works. And my buddy John is, he's our wine guy. You know, you were talking about the experience. He's the guy that, No one knows what we're to drink other than him. And he hooks us up every time. And so I'm so grateful that you have now given me something to talk to him about, because this is awesome. And I'm certain that our listeners have learned a lot, because what a unique business. Everybody drinks a lot of wine. And to learn how this is made and the mechanics behind it, I hope we'll find some people that are willing to give it a go and get into this industry. So thanks for all your time. I know we went long, and I'm certainly grateful, you know, that you were willing to
it was a pleasure.
Take a couple extra minutes with me
with you. And I, you know, since I love what I do and I love the industry that I'm in, it's really easy to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, you made it super easy for someone like me to understand it. And if I can understand it, others will too. So I have everything about you will be in the show notes. So don't hesitate to, those of you listening, don't hesitate to look to the show notes, because everything that we've talked about and more will be there. So, all right. Well, Genevieve, thank you so much. And I am so happy.
Well, it was a pleasure.
We finally got together.
Very happy to be on your show. And it was fun.
Right on.
Thank you for joining us today on the How to Sell Your Business podcast. If you want more episodes packed with strategies to help sell your business for the maximum value, visit howtosellabusinesspodcast.com for tips and best practices to make your exit life-changing. Better yet, subscribe now so you never miss future episodes. This program is copyrighted by MISO Inc. All rights reserved.